coming to you from the City of the Weird. Exploring topics from the esoteric and unexplored to dimensions unknown. Shining a light of truth on the darkest corners of our reality. Welcome to the Curious Realm. Hello, hello. Welcome to episode 13 and happy Mardi Gras, everybody. Happy Mardi Gras. Les le bon ton roulé to all of you out there in Mardi Gras land and in the home of my heart, Mamou, Louisiana, the home of Cajun music out there. Hope all you guys had a great Mardi Gras. Hope it was nice and cold and muddy, the way that Mardi Gras is supposed to be while you're out there chasing dim chickens and everything else. Mardi Gras safe, folks. Make sure to mask up while you're around strangers inside. All that kind of good stuff. Tonight's episode, I am so excited to get into this because we will be talking with our good friend, Dr. Richard B. Spence, who spent years teaching at the University of Idaho in the realm of Russian-U.S. intelligence relations. He will be our guest in the first part of the show, discussing the history of the Ukraine and Russia and what that is all about, kind of how we got to this situation that we're in now. And then in the second part of the episode, we will be talking with a friend of mine who actively lives in the Kyiv area, Anton Schulke, who codes and works for Duda, kind of a WordPress type platform. Go out and check that out, folks. But he is giving us kind of a boots on the ground report of what it is like over there and spending a few hours a day in a shelter. And our interview was cut short actively because of shelling. So he was like, "Ooh, you hear that in the background? I gotta go. We're gonna hop into the shelter." Probably the wildest end of an interview I've ever had. So stay tuned for that. So much more. Whenever we come back from our commercial break, we'll be having Anton on. While you're online checking this out, folks, make sure to stop on by The Curious Realm. That is where you can find everything Curious Realm, including the store, all of our great stuff over there. As well as our new Ukraine page, curiousrealm.com/Ukraine will take you there. And I'm trying to find more authorized feeds that are allowed to be shared, things like that. But this is actually a live feed that we will be popping up sporadically throughout the night. Our good friend Dr. John Hall directed me to this, and I put it up and quoted the people. And, you know, this is their official link, so any views will actively be going to them. But stop on by and check that out. That is a great view from the inside of what is actively going on in the Kyiv area from here on out, folks. So stop on by and check that out. Also, we have our news of the week. News of the week comes to you from our Facebook group, the Curious Realm Facebook group over here. Plenty of stuff in there out of the dailymail.uk. Ukraine war, Belarus dictator stands in front of battle map on live TV. That's pretty brazen to be announcing battle plans on live TV. News.cornell.edu tells us that the Zeno effect has been verified. Atoms will not move while you watch them. That's out of the Cornell Chronicle. Out of fizz.org, earthworms have the potential to replace the use of synthetic fertilizers. I don't know. To me, that kind of makes perfect sense. Out of futurism.com, an MIT startup is drilling 12 miles into the earth to suck out energy. And out of social on TechCrunch, Facebook and Instagram cut the reach of Russian state media. It has been, That is just some of the news of the week there. Stop on by, join the Facebook group, join the conversation, folks. That is just some of the stuff going on there right now. There are tons more articles, tons more stuff. Welcome back our guest, Richard B. Spence, author of Secret Agent 666, as well as author of the book Wall Street and the Russian Revolution. How are you doing today, Professor?
I'm doing pretty well, Christopher. Thanks for having me on the show.
Absolutely. Welcome back. Whenever I was considering this topic and talking about it and actively doing a show about it, I was like, you know, I need to get somebody that as we said in our pre-show conversation, whenever I called you, we could hear saying conjecture and divine things all day long. The more important thing is, how did we get here? That's often, I think, the lesson that is forgotten is how we got here. You know, how did we get to the situation of Russia invading Ukraine? Even as I said in our pre-show conversation, with the Crimean absorption in 2014, that kind of set the stage for this. How did we even intelligence-wise miss out on what seemed to be pretty big red flags? So,
I mean, the Crimean referendum in 2014. Well, let me start out by saying that, you know, you got some really action-packed stuff coming up in that latter part of the show. So I guess I'm going to give the kind of, you know, boring academic introduction to things.
But an important introduction.
But pay attention in history class, and we'll see what we can do. Let me touch on the 2014 thing now, but then I want to take it a little bit further than that. Actually, if you go back to 2014... in the so-called Crimean crisis, it was widely covered in the press. There was no secret that this didn't happen in the middle of the night. Everybody knew about it. There was you get into nationalities within sub-nationalities, and the basic thing of it, argument back and forth, but the reality was that from an ethnic standpoint, Crimea was overwhelmingly Russian. It wasn't Ukrainian. And partly as Ukraine began to veer more into a Ukrainian state, people who didn't feel all that Ukrainian, you know, you wake up one morning and find you're Ukrainian. Many of them, I don't know what percentage, but a significant number of them began to feel uncomfortable and wanted their way out of it in the same way that Ukraine wanted its way out of the USSR and every former colonial country has wanted its way out of the empire. So there's also, one can argue over to what degree Moscow instigated the Russian nationalist sentiment in Crimea or that it was already there, but there had to be something you could stir up for there to be anything to it. So there was a movement that developed. There was a declaration of independence, and then there was a vote. Was it a fair vote? I don't know. I didn't count them. But there was a referendum taken. It's the way these things are done internationally. And the majority of Crimea's inhabitants voted to join Russia. And then that was accepted by the Russian Duma. So there was a process that took place. And all of this is there within the media. And in fact, there were sanctions levied against Russia that are still in place.
Yep.
That are involved in that. It's never really been internationally recognized. It's what you call, you know, a fait accompli. You know, it's de facto, but still most of, I don't think the United States, for instance, formally recognizes Crimea as part of Russia, but it is. So, but the bigger question of the Ukraine, it's not just about Crimea, is one of those things. So, you know, I got a limited amount of time, so let me take things very briefly all the way back to the 9th century.
Please.
Okay. Not the 8th, not the 10th, but the 9th century. So the 9th century is basically the beginning of a period. It's when essentially the idea of a Russian or Eastern Slavic culture begins to emerge. And what you get in the area that now forms part of what's Russia and Ukraine and Belarus in that all that area, There was it's not a country, it's a kind of political entity, which meant it was a loose-knit, quarreling federation of principalities and tribes called Kievan Rus, not Russia, Rus. And it all sort of coalesced in the 9th century, and that's also when it converted to Orthodox Christianity. And that, which, you know, arguably sort of brought it into the European fold. But so notice this is called Kievan Rus, and the reason it's called the Kievan Rus period is that Kiev, whatever you want to call it, but Kiev's the way I'm used to saying it, so I'm going to keep saying it that way.
Sure.
Kiev was the center of it. It was the religious and economic capital of this kind of loose-knit federation of quarreling principalities. So that's where, in that culture, is the root of both modern Russia and Ukraine. So they are born out of the same Kievan Rus culture. I don't think you get a whole lot of argument on that. Now, there are other things else, but you know, there was this common point. But here's one of the questions, you know, the real issue that exists right now. I mean, what's the war all about? And if you could boil it down, on the Russian side is, you know, certainly the Russian nationalist side, which heavily backs this war, is that the Ukraine is not now, nor has ever been, a separate nation, not a separate people. That it is a variation, it is a regional variant of a greater Russian people. So that modern Russians and Ukrainians are all part of an Eastern Slavic Orthodox Christian culture that goes back to Kievan Rus, right? And on the other hand, the Ukrainian nationalist argument basically is the Ukraine is not now, nor has it ever been, the same thing as Russia, that it has always existed as some kind of separate entity. And that, again, both of those positions are, you know, very sort of black and white ways of seeing it, that Ukraine is simply a subset of Russia. No, that Ukraine is and always has been something separate from Russia. So this is why you can get people arguing over whether, you know, Kievan Rus' culture was predominantly Russian. No, it was predominantly Ukrainian. Well, it wasn't either one of them because, you know, hey, yeah, it's the 9th century. So there was no such thing. If you go back to the period of Kievan Rus, which lasts all the way up to the 13th century, so it's around for a while. So we're talking about, you know, sort of the middle ages, I guess. That there's, while both modern Ukrainian and Russian cultures, you know, derive from that, neither of those cultures existed in that form back then. I mean, there wasn't any such thing, yeah, as Russians or Ukrainians. There were a variety of different, you know, Christianized Eastern Slavic people, probably speaking a whole number of different dialects, having different customs, and they lived in this sort of loose, ramshackle thing called Kievan Rus that got destroyed by the Mongols. Okay? So that then issues on the next phase, and this is where I think things get important. So Kievan Rus was this kind of, you know, mix, this sort of alchemical stew out of which Russia and Ukraine, but they did, you know, you can't really prove that either one of them existed as a concept, as an idea back at that time. So what happens is that the Mongols show up, middle of the 13th century, burn the hell out of everything, burn Kiev to the ground, burn most of the other cities, and the lands that had been part of Kievan Rus, had been part of that earlier East Slavic civilization, are divided. The western portions, which would include Ukraine and Belarus, fall under the control of Poland. I mean, first they fall under control of something called the Grand Duchy of Lithuania, which I'm not going to explain, but then Lithuania gets sort of absorbed by Poland. But what's really going to happen is that those areas are going to spend the next 300 to 400 years under Polish rule. And that means a lot of influence from Poland. And the Poles, by the way, are Roman Catholics. So the Slavic peoples, yes, living in what would be Ukraine are still Orthodox Christians. They still are today. That's one of the things they have. They still share in common with Russians, whether either one of them really wants to admit it, but that they still have. But the Poles were in some way, even though they were Catholics, they were religiously different. There was also a fair amount of influence. So, you know, an argument has been made. I don't swear to it. I'm not a linguist. But one of the ways to understand many of the differences probably between modern Ukrainian and Russian is that Ukrainian was subjected to centuries of Polish linguistic influence, which means that words passed from Polish into Ukrainian, maybe elements of pronunciation. And anyway, you know, a lot of water went under the bridge. Now, meanwhile, to the east, up in an area that around what was called the Vladimir Suzdal area, you had other eastern principalities of Kiev and Rus that had fallen under the domination of the Mongols. The Mongols later turned into a thing called the Golden Horde, which is a lot more interesting than it actually, you know, sounds more interesting than it actually is. And also, they were Muslims. So the Ukraine ends up by Poles, ends up under the rule of Polish Catholic. The Russians end up under the domination of Islamic Mongols, which, you know, still left the area. There was no mass conversion of those people. But and the Russians weren't under Mongol domination as long, but what would become the Russians, the Muscovites, spent about 200 to 250 years under the political and economic domination of the Mongols. So one of the things those two different experiences did is that they had a profoundly, you know, you were living for centuries under the control and influences of different cultures. So on the other hand, the Mongols didn't rule Muscovy and those eastern principalities directly. They left Russian rulers in charge. And that's basically how Moscow grew, because the Prince of Moscow was sort of, you know, actually initially he sucked up to the Mongols and would beat up other Russian princes for them to keep them in line. And in doing so, his power grew, whereas in the principalities controlled by Poland, they were under the control of the Polish state. There was the Polish nobility tended to replace whatever sort of nobility was there before. So the what would become the Ukrainian population were basically just subject peasants under Polish landlords.
Interesting.
So that brings us back to this whole question about where the term Ukraine comes from, and even whether it's Ukraine or the Ukraine. You've heard that argument. So it's Ukraine in either Ukrainian or Russian because there are no articles in those languages. In other words, you don't talk. There's no the.
Yeah.
You simply don't have those. And how do they figure out what's a and the? Well, they do. So there's no article, so it makes absolutely no sense. Although the way that that term would be translated into English as is the borderlands. So it's one of those areas that what the term refers to isn't a country, and it doesn't refer to a people. So in other words, there was never really until you get to the 20th century, any particular historical tribe or nation of people called Ukrainians, because Ukraine was just a zone. It referred to a kind of step frontier between the lands that were controlled by Poland or one of the former principalities, basically where there were Christian Slavs, and then the open steppes to the south down to the Black Sea that were controlled by the Tatars. So that whole area, those lands didn't really extend to the Black Sea because those was an area called the Wild Steppes. And this was a kind of, it's like a Comanche frontier, all right? You had the Tatars, they would raid back at you. You had Cossacks, who were Christian Slav land pirates fighting the Tatars. But it referred to an area. It didn't refer to a people. There was never some tribe of people called Ukrainians.
Yeah.
Because Ukraine was simply this area. So that was a term that would much later become attached to a nation. But the thing to keep in mind is that historically it's not the name of a nation and it's not the name of a people. It's, you know, like so many countries, it's a kind of euphemism that people pick up. So the Russian Empire doesn't really get control. They start to gain control of Ukraine in wars with Poland. So here again, we'll make history very quick. The Muscovite state grows. It eventually throws off, by 1450 or so, it has thrown off the control of the Tatars and defeated them. It becomes an increasingly powerful state by gobbling up other Russian principalities until it's the only one. And then it seizes its mission to what is called the recovery of the Russian lands, which means to reconquer the territories of former Kievan Rus from the awful hand of the Catholic Poles and Lithuanians. So that begins this centuries of warfare between Russia and Poland, and it goes back and forth and back and forth. But in the middle of the 17th century, in 1667, if you want the exact year. The Russians win one of their wars against Poland, and they impose a peace treaty on Poland that forces the Poles to surrender large chunks of that area that would later become Ukraine, including Kiev. Okay, this is when the Russians first occupy Kiev. And there have been other things going on. There was this huge peasant rebellion that preceded that. And, you know, you get arguments as to whether or not the Russians instigated the rebellion or the rebels, you know, asked the Russians for help. And the Russians came and, you know, they get into this whole life. I mean, again, in the 17th century, I'd argue that the real concept even of sort of Russian and Ukrainian identity doesn't really exist. I'm not sure that most peasants had any particular idea what they were, other than the fact that they were Orthodox Christians. That's generally how people identified themselves. So the thing is that what we can't do, this is one of the people, you know, this is, for instance, is what nationalists generally do. And I'm not saying that nationalism is bad, but I'm saying that nationalists are generally short-sighted propagandists in promoting their own national religion. And what they do is they consistently apply current definitions to the past, where they simply didn't exist. You know, in the same way that you can't go back to the 12th century and talk about somebody being English in a modern sense, or even French. Those sort of identities don't, you know, took time to kind of coalesce. Yeah. So what you had was the Russian state sort of became independent. It became self-conscious. It began to absorb. It also had this doctrine of being the Third Rome, and its job was to recover the lands of Kiev and Rus and to restore Orthodox Christian rule over Orthodox Christians, because in their view, you know, Catholics ruling Orthodox Christians was just, well, wrong.
Yeah.
So the Poles sometimes had it their way in that war. There was one brief period that they actually, you know, were about to conquer Muscovy, but that didn't work. And thereafter, the war went against them. And so finally, in the late 1700s, or let me put it this way, around the same time of the American Revolution, Catherine the Great, the Empress of Russia, which has continued to expand and expand, basically, along with the Prussians and the Austrians, partitions the Polish state out of existence. All the lands of Poland are divided up between those three empires, with Russia taking overwhelmingly the largest amount and taking almost all of the areas that comprised, you know, what you could call modern Ukraine. Remember, it's not Ukraine then, but most of those lands were comprised in the area that Catherine the Great acquired. And Catherine the Great also did something else. You know those wild steppes, that area down along the Black Sea that was pretty much uninhabited? Well, the other thing she did was that she conquered the Tatars. She put the nomads out of business. But here again is one of these things that's often overlooked. Those areas were unsettled and unpopulated, and she didn't move people from what we now call Ukraine, just on the other side of the border. She moved in peasants from central Russia, from Muscovy. And so she heavily populated that area with Russians. And so that's one of the things you still see today, is that the south, the Black Sea regions, areas like the Donbass that Russians migrated into for work, and Crimea, are significantly to predominantly pro-Russian in their sentiment and identity. So there's something like roughly, I've seen different figures, around a quarter of the Ukrainian population before war, going back to really the 1990s, viewed itself as ethnically Russian. In other words, they don't even say we're Ukrainians. We're Russians living in Ukraine.
Absolutely.
So there is, keep in mind, a significant minority which exists there. But that's how that came about. That's why, if you look at the, if somebody's interested, go and look at electoral maps of Ukraine. Go look at the different elections they have. And there was almost always one sort of pro-Moscow and anti-Moscow candidate. And look how the vote turns out. And you will see like a line. You will see the north and the west of Ukraine will vote one way. The south and the east will vote completely the opposite. So there is a, you know, but that's the reason why these divisions exist. I mean, why Ukraine itself has a separatist movement, why it has restive Russian minorities, has to do with history. You know, I've seen some Ukrainians argue that, no, the Russians only came there because the Soviets moved them in. We can blame everything on the communists at this point, who, of course, also built
always.
Everything.
But, always.
But anyway, but So we can blame everything on the commies, but no, there was a ethnic mosaic in what would become Ukraine all the way back to the 18th century. But again, I'd point out that if a Russian chauvinist basically argues that, well, we've always controlled Ukraine, it's always been part of Russia until the Poles took it away for 20 years. No. Okay. You know, the Russian state had no control of most of Ukraine really until the late 18th century. That is not much more than 200 years ago. Now, another little interesting detail is that under the rule of the Tsars, from Catherine the Great all the way up to Nicholas II in 1917, if you look at a map of Tsarist Russia, and somebody should Google one, if you look at the provinces of Tsarist Russia, and if you look closely, and you will notice that there is not a single province which is called Ukraine. There is no Ukraine in the map of the Russian Empire of the Tsars. It does not exist. Again, as other than a geographic expression. It's still, now referred to the area, sort of the southern area now along the Black Sea. But there's no province. What will become Ukraine is composed of provinces, but none of them are called Ukraine. Nor in the official ethnic count of the Tsarist Empire are there any people called Ukrainians? Well, because there's no Ukraine. They're generally just referred to like Russians as Orthodox Christians. That's pretty much the way you were counted in the census. But the other term which was used was Malorossi, Little Russians. Okay, and the area of Ukraine was sometimes recalled to as Malorossia, Little Russia, or Lesser Russia, which you can imagine that modern Ukrainian nationalists really hate.
Yeah.
Because, if you don't want to be called a Russian, you're really going to get your knickers in a bunch if you're called a little Russian.
Yeah.
So, but that was, but one of the things that shows you is that it shows you that in the view of the Tsarist Empire, Ukrainians were basically just a regional variation of Russian. But that issue didn't come in. So when does modern Ukrainian nationalism come along? Well, here's the thing about nationalisms, and nationalisms are different from ethnicity.
Absolutely.
So ethnicity is something which is usually, based upon heredity. Ethnicity usually involves biology and language. Nationality doesn't have to involve either one of those. And let me give you something which is an example that I think a lot of people overlook when we talk about nationality. The United States and Canada share much of their history and institutions and roughly origins in common. Not true. There are exceptions. Southwestern United States is much more Hispanic. You don't have that in Canada. And then, of course, we got Quebec, okay, which raises the whole question, are French Canadians just a variant of Canadian, or are they something separate? Are they Quebecois? There's a question there. But at any rate, if you look at the U.S. and Canada, they're almost alike, aren't they?
Even deeper than that, today, Mardi Gras, not many people realize that the Cajun people are a mix of the Acadians who were actively exiled from French Canada, the Acadia region just above Maine, and mixed with the indigenous Indian people in Louisiana, and that's specifically where the Cajuns came from.
So Cajun is a good example of an ethnicity.
Exactly.
Okay? Again, it's based upon heredity, experience, but language, this idea. But when you get to, Americans, broadly speaking, I'll just make a sweeping brush here, and Canadians are pretty much this. A Martian wouldn't be able to tell them apart, would he?
Yeah, okay. Absolutely not.
I mean, particularly, I may be influenced by the fact that I live out west, and therefore the Canada I'm, used to visiting is Alberta and British Columbia. And I mean, if you go from Washington into British Columbia, you have not gone to another planet. It's the same place, just the gas is sold in different things and they have kilometers. But other than that, it's the same. Now, on the other hand, is it fair to say that there is a separate Canadian national identity as opposed to Americans?
I would say most definitely.
Most definitely.
Most definitely.
Some people might be iffy on it, but for the most part, Canadians think they're Canadians. Why do they think they're Canadians? Do they think they're Canadians because they're different from the Americans that live across the border? No. Basically, it's because they've been born in a place called Canada, and they've been told all their life that they're Canadians.
Yeah.
Okay. And the one thing that the way, you know, Canadians may or may not like this, but a Canadian told me this, is he goes, the one thing that makes you a Canadian is that you're not an American.
Yeah.
That's pretty much it.
Yeah.
It's not that you're not like them. You don't speak the same language they do. You both shop at Walmart. You both listen to country music, have mm-hmm. guns in a car rack in your pickup. The point is that you're a Canadian, which you identify as being something different. And if you think about it, that is the flimsiest thing, but it's powerful. Because the thing about national identities is that they're religions. They're secular religions.
Yes, yes.
I mean, think for a minute, what makes an American? I mean, really, you know.
Well, and I just had the discussion the other day with a documentary crew about the mentality of the true believer. Be it religious, be it nationalism, be it Illuminati is trying to harvest your adrenochrome and rule the world. Doesn't really matter, Doc. It's the fact that it is a mentality that builds that, whether it's nationalism, whether it's religion, whether it's the religion of science, you know, wanting to down or poo-poo hypotheses from other people, you know, that I think that is a big, big issue the whole world over, whether it be political or not.
Well, it's a thing, you know, this is a topic for some other time and probably some other
sure.
show, but you know, what human beings do with anything is that they turn it into a religion. They take anything.
Yeah.
They turn national identity into a religion. They turn sports into a religion. They turn atheism into a religion.
Yes.
Okay. Atheism, therefore, you know, becomes rather than simply being contemptuous indifference, which is what you assume it might be, instead it becomes a kind of active hostility campaigning against the thing that you believe doesn't exist, which is kind of weird.
Yeah.
So
which means you now have to embody what you actively believe doesn't exist.
Yeah.
So that you can spin it up.
So human beings turn everything into some form of religion. And nationalism becomes the same sort of thing. And if you look at American national identity is certainly, if it ever was, it is no longer based upon any particular ethnicity. Okay? There are all kinds of definable ethnicities. The census divides you by ethnicity. You choose, you know, when you check that box, you know, whatever it may be, whatever the box of your choice, you are identifying as an ethnicity, but you're not identifying as a nation, because what makes you an American citizen really is you all pay taxes to the same central government. And they issue your passports.
Yep.
But speaking English doesn't make you an American. Being any particular color or origin doesn't make you an American. Nothing makes you an American other than being the political subject of the United States.
Yes.
That's it.
Yes. Yeah.
And that's, you know, you know, it's one of those things that seems to work. It sort of held things together. It's interesting as to whether that's a concept which is fraying, you know. We'll see how that holds up. Historically, whether you can eventually maintain that, but
I think it's a frail infrastructure the whole way around, whether you're talking nationalism with, and you know, this is coming, folks, from somebody who I was a seminarian doctor. Like, I studied to be a priest and wear a collar, but I am here to tell you, if you're not of an open mind and willing to accept another thought form, you yourself are the weak link.
Yeah, so the question comes down, what is national identity really about? It's usually something which is based on a made-up history.
Mm.
You know, it's one of the things you have to have. There was a fellow, I won't say who I heard talking the other day, you know, a fellow who knows something about this period, and he was going, well, you know what, you know, what is this sort of defines Ukrainian nationalism? And, you know, so what is the national identity? And he goes, well, national identity is the shared vision of a common future.
Yes.
I'm paraphrasing, that's what it comes down to. And I think that's completely, because I'm a historian, I think that's completely backward. No, it's the shared version of a common past.
Yes.
Because you can only envision some kind of national future out of some sort of past. And if you don't have a real past, you know, and the issue is if you fish around in the past and you look for Russia or you look for Ukraine or other places, it's generally not until recently that you actually find them.
Yeah.
So I think, as I was going to mention, the concept of the modern Ukrainian state really dates from the mid-19th century, and nothing with a country with the name Ukraine on it comes into existence until the early 20th century, then only briefly.
And even then, not until the actual fall of the USSR.
Well, there was, when Russia collapsed in the Russian Revolution in 1917, you had Ukrainian nationalists who showed up right after the fall of the Tsar, and they basically demanded the creation of Ukrainian army units. And this is really when you begin to talk about a Ukrainian nation, and they demanded autonomy within the empire. And then during the Russian Civil War that followed, there was a Ukrainian national government that kind of came and went. And in fact, there were really two or three different short-lived Ukrainian states. And I want to understand in this case that I'm not trying to belittle or denigrate Ukrainian nationalism, the Ukrainian state, but just the way it was.
Yeah, yeah.
All right? The Ukrainian People's Republic lasted a couple of months at best. The Ukrainian Hetmanate, which was backed up by the Germans, lasted a few more months. And then the ever-super Stuart got beat by the Bolsheviks, all right?
Yeah. And even right here, it's from 1917 to 1922. Like, for us folks, just to put it into terms for you, that's a presidential term.
So, it was a chaotic time. And there was this thing that called itself the Ukrainian People's Republic, and it had a small army, and it would ally with this or that. But you weren't able to actually create a sustaining Ukrainian state. And so really, Ukraine as a functional independent entity in a modern sense does indeed come into being with the breakup of the USSR in 1991. And then what people had to do, people who wanted this shared Ukrainian identity, needed to create that identity from things out in the past. And that usually means arguing that there was a self-conscious Ukrainian national identity back, I don't know, in the 14th, 15th, 16th, 17th century. But really nobody had much of one back then. But it brings it down is that national identities are things that people make up. They're narratives. They're a plot line.
Sure.
They're a script.
Yeah.
Prime example
would be Thanksgiving. That is part of our national identity.
Yeah.
But when you actively go to until recent times, and until you come to like the last maybe decade in some very enlightened school districts, do you get the actual history of what happened with the settlers at the first Thanksgiving? Like when I grew up, hey man, it was Peanuts Thanksgiving and everybody was friends and they helped us live, and like, forget the bounty on people's heads that existed, never mind that.
Let's put it this way. None of those pilgrims sitting around Thanksgiving tables had any concept of themselves as Americans.
That's
as we
right.
Think of it.
Absolutely.
They were English
true.
Religious dissidents. They were above all else. What did they view themselves as? True Christians. And they were English. They were subjects of the king, however reluctantly. And they had left this place because things were too hot for them back home.
Yeah.
They were not Americans. They had no concept of being Americans. They had no concept of what America was. So while today in our national mythology, we embrace Thanksgiving as this kind of, bonding element, national holiday, that's not what it was.
Absolutely.
I mean, keep in mind, the Puritans wouldn't want anything to do with most of us.
Yeah. I wouldn't even say that we had a national identity till a good 25 years after 1776. Because we still had the Whiskey Rebellion that happened, which was basically like a miniature Civil War before the Civil War. We don't have an actual identity for a good clip, and then we kind of destroy it and rebuild. That's what the whole reconstruction period is about, is the rebuilding of our identity as we know it now.
This takes us into a completely different rabbit hole that I don't want to go into.
No, absolutely not.
But the whole thing is that arguably, okay, this is an argument, not a fact, there is arguably at the root of the Civil War is the Southern concept or the widespread sentiment in the South that they had a different culture and a different national identity.
Yep.
And that, you know, the opposite of that were the Yankees. And therefore, what are we? We are not Yankees.
Yeah.
And we wish to have a separate existence with our peculiar institutions because we don't recognize a common identity.
Yeah. Yeah.
So these type of things go, identities are things, this doesn't mean the identities aren't real, but the thing to keep in mind is that they're invented and they're changeable.
That's right.
And because national identities are like religious beliefs, they're also things that people can be converted to or converted away from. So if you put enough stuff in the public school system somewhere to convince people that, give you a couple other historical examples. In the middle of the 19th century, Germany and Italy, which had been composed of a number of different states for as long as they had existed, unified into the Kingdom of Italy and the German Empire. The first time that really anything called Italy as a state and Germany as a political state had existed.
Yeah.
So one of the things that you had to do, one of the things that public officials realized, let's say within Germany, is that we have to, in a sense, Germanize everybody. Because what we've got are Protestants and Catholics, and we've got Bavarians and Prussians, and they ain't the same, and Rhinelanders and Silesians, and semi-Lithuanians from East Prussia, and Hanoverian merchants. And we now have to take all these people who for centuries have never been unified and have really done no more than kind of shared a common folk culture and different dialects of the same language. We now have to turn them into Germans.
Yeah, we now got to put them all in the same sausage casing and
make sure they're together. That we do that is that we do it through the schools.
Yeah.
We make sure that the Germanness and German history, as we want to invent it and tell it, will be taught to everyone so that they will all be convinced, they will come out of school believing that they are Germans before the being Bavarians or anything else. The same thing in Italy. In Italy, you'd have to know Italy, but you were going to try to combine Sicilians with Milanese from the north. Okay? People from Milan, urbaners from Milan, are going to be combined with Sicilians. And, they would vaguely speak the same language. And other than that, they didn't have a whole hell of a lot in common. But again, the concept was to, and by the way, that has never, particularly if you look at Italy, that has never been accomplished. Northern Italy is extremely different from southern Italy. Not as different as it used to be, but if you go from one end of the country to the other, you will see great differences. And there is a very clear sense of being from the south or being. In fact, if you look closely, you'll find out that most of northern Italy has unofficially declared its independence as the country of Padania. Why? Because they don't want to be combined in the same country with those stinking southerners anymore, as they see it. Right? That's it. They think that southern Italy is just full of a bunch of people who, and I'm not saying that, but this is the way they would see it. It's full of a bunch of people who don't work, who feed off the public heat, get all the money from Rome, probably used to vote communist, and are probably in the mafia. Okay? So we don't want anything to do with them. And, the southerners tend to view the northerners as effete intellectual snobs.
think
you're better than...
It's interesting. No different than our regional differences here in America. I lived in the Northeast, and my Lord, I can tell you that some of the rhetoric that I heard in the Northeast was no different than what I have heard from deep, deep Southerners, except directed toward other people.
Those differences are there. I mean, you can even get little things. I was thinking recently where for some reason the topic of Jesse James came up. And it was basically the discussion is Jesse James is one of the great outlaws of the Old West. Now, you got to keep in mind, I was born in California. I live in Idaho. I am, you know, and actually come from people who lived in the West before that. So that's kind of the center of the world for me.
Yeah.
You know, as I guess it's like New Yorkers see everything from Manhattan. And I guess I see everything from sort of west of the Rockies somehow. So I'm listening to that and I go, Jesse James wasn't on the Old West. You know, he was in Missouri and Tennessee and Kentucky. Okay, see, from my standpoint, it's not the West until you get over the Rocky Mountains. Okay, even Denver is questionable. It's right on the cusp of the Midwest. But Missouri, Wild West, you know, that just seems to be bizarre.
Yeah.
But that's a tiny little thing. But it does sort of indicate that there's this kind of mental picture or idea of what the West constitutes that I have, which is very different from what these people, and I think probably maybe many other people have. But I don't think I'm alone in that.
Well, no, absolutely not. And that's just it. Like, I was born in 1975. We are basically right now living like every movie from my childhood, Doctor. Like, whether it's Rambo or Red Dawn, what have you, like, we're in the middle of even War Games. Like, you know, you're talking about Putin having his nuclear arsenal on alert status right now.
Here's one of these basic factors you have to think of. Who has the biggest nuclear arsenal in the world?
Not us.
Russia.
Yeah.
Russia.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, we're close second.
Ours is far more accurate, but I think they were much more concerned with just a slave of destruction.
Well,
than accuracy.
I mean, that's one of those things that's an assumption because nobody's really tried that, have they?
Well, no. That's just it. Yeah. So much of this. Yeah. And that's one reason why I wanted to have you on is because you taught a course in Russian U.S. intelligence relations for almost 20 years, man. Like, if there's anybody that I want to talk about this Ukraine thing with, it's you. Because even right now, when you're talking about the standards of warfare, my next guest, folks, just so you know, was not on via Starlink. He was not on via like wireless satellite Wi-Fi. He had hard line connection. He had power in his house, and he lives in Kyiv. So under just standard quote battle plan, if you're trying to invade a place, you normally cut the communications, man. You normally cut the power. And you know, even going to our Ukraine feed, like, there's city lights on. Now, granted, most of the lights are turned off due to air raid and things like that. But there are full-on city lights on in other parts of Kyiv. So,
that comes down to questions in some cases that, you know, particularly if you're planning to assume ownership of something, how much damage do you want to do in acquiring it?
Yeah.
Because you destroy Kiev's power plants.
Sure.
And then you take Kiev, then you're going to have to rebuild those power plants.
Yeah.
So it's easier to try to do it without taking those factors out. You know, if I was going to just, you know, briefly sum up what I've said so far, is that here roughly what I, well, this is how I think we got to the present situation, is that what some people might call nationalist zealots, I'll simply say a defined wing of nationalism, both Russian and Ukrainian, those people who've defined a particular identity in history have taken control of the situation. And that's why I think it's important to keep in mind is that the Russian situation is not being personally determined by Putin. Okay, Putin becomes a symbol for a lot of things.
Absolutely not.
But there is a, I don't know how big it is. I don't know whether it's a majority consensus or significant, but there are a lot of people in Russia who believe in this idea of a unified Russian people in which Ukraine is historically inseparable from some sort of patrimony. And they are determined to bring about the manifestation of their shared vision of the future based upon their imaginary vision of the past. And in the Ukrainian side, you have exactly the same thing, who are determined to manifest their version of the future based upon their imaginary version of the past.
Yeah.
And that's really, that's fundamentally what's at conflict. Okay, it's not Putin and Zelensky. It's not Putin. It's not just this.
Yeah.
I mean, it's anybody who's interested in this could look at some of the speeches that, you know, in the Russian Duma, the parliament. There are people who stand up and say all kinds of things, intelligent, idiotic, just like in our Congress.
Yeah.
And I mean, there, one of the things, you know, that Putin was being pushed on is that you have to do something. You have to do something. You can't let these republics down. I mean, he was being told over and over again, you know, that the Donbass republics have to be protected. And, you know, the Ukrainians are going to attack them and try to reconquer them. That we have to defend our fellow Russians. We have to defend the greater idea.
Lord forbid some shrapnel land on Poland.
Yep.
You know, like you want to talk about something lighting off. And that's what I think a lot of people really don't realize is it, just how close that is, you know. But I don't think that he is. I think that, like you're saying, there is a cadre of people who for years have been much like before Hitler. There were people that were trying to reunite the German states. You know,
Germany
and to expand. And I think now that very much there has been for a long time. I mean, since Trotsky, things like that, the concept of reuniting Mother Russia, bringing Mother Russia back together, you know, and that was before, like when before Putin was even in the KGB, there were people calling for this. It just happens to be that now Ukraine is an independent state, and they used to be part of Mother Russia.
Well, it's, you know, the Soviets would have said, well, we were never Mother Russia, even though in a way we were. But you really had, you know, the Tsarist Empire gave way to the Soviet Empire, which had its own state religion of communism.
Yeah.
And when that religion sort of, you know, fizzled out or whatever it was that happened in the late 1980s and early 1990s, one of the things that Russia has had to find, one of the things they've done is, again, to have to resurrect this idea of the glorious Russian past and of a unified Russian state going back to Kiev and Rus. I mean, keep in mind, they've had to redefine who they are. And one of the things, and it's an interesting thing to keep in mind that In the Soviet Union, or even in the bigger Russian Empire, ethnic Russians per se were only about half the population.
Yeah.
So in the Soviet period, the Russian language, Russian culture, Russians mostly for the most part tended to dominate everything because there were more of them than there were everybody else. But they're only about half the population. So when you talk about Soviets, you're again talking about Ukrainians, Belarusians, Armenians, Georgians, yada yada yada. But when the USSR broke up, the area that became the Russian Federation then became a state which was more than 85% Russian. It became a national state. Instead of being an empire in which Russians were simply the largest ethnic component, it now became a national state in which Russians comprise the vast majority of the population, and therefore it much more became their country. Yeah. And they began to increasingly get the idea of being Russians. You know, not Soviets, not Orthodox Christians, not subjects of the Tsar, but being Russians. And the other thing is that in Ukraine, and even in some degree in the Baltic states and elsewhere, there were 20 million Russians who lived in what were called the near abroad. That is, your ethnic kinsmen, since now this was the most important thing, your ethnic kinsmen were living across these artificial Soviet-created boundaries. I mean, after all, when you talk about the, you know, sacrosanct narrative, you know, character of Soviet-era boundaries, you're talking about boundaries created by those pesky communists, right? Who, remember, can't do anything right. But nevertheless, somehow, you know, the borders, which they often created to exacerbate political There was a reason why often in Soviet republics they'd always include elements occupied by other ethnic groups, so there'd always be some smaller groups to play off against whatever the local majority was.
Yeah.
It was always playing people off against each other. But I think that's, you know, that's the situation we have. And how is all of this going to turn out? If anybody's, you know, I don't know.
Hey,
neither does anybody else.
You are very, very much like me in the fact that you do not like to play groundhog and prognosticator.
No.
You like to look at facts, distill history, things like that. And thank you so much for coming on, because I think that this gives people a much deeper understanding of what is going on and why in that region and what the motivations are. Now, granted, once again, as of yet, and much like our guest coming up will say, like, Putin has achieved nothing as of yet. He ain't going anywhere. If you think that this thing is over despite peace talks right now or anything like that, no way, no how. He has militarily achieved nothing, and he will not leave without achieving something.
From the Russian standpoint, the only way this I'm going to violate my rule and prognosticate. I just say this: one of two things is going to happen. Either the situation on the Russian side, you either have to escalate it substantially, or you have to de-escalate it substantially.
Exactly.
You cannot stay in the middle.
Yeah.
So you've either got to call up reserves, pour in more troops, blow, you know.
Yeah, you've either got to double down or pull out entirely.
You know, no more Mr. Nice Guy.
Okay. Yeah.
No more, you know, somebody would say pussyfooting around,
yeah,
which to some degree I think they've been doing.
Yeah.
I think they thought it was going to be a lot easier, and they just sort of waltzed in and thought, you know, everything's going to sort of collapse in 5 minutes and they'll all surrender. And most of them didn't. But you've now got the Ukrainian army effectively can't maneuver. And so it's essentially holed up in the cities. I mean, that's the safest place to be. Get into the cities where, you know, you got lots of civilian infrastructure and you've got, you know, you can draw the opponent into street fighting. Simply seems the safest way to do. So you've got the situation of the Russians basically increasingly going around investing cities. So that's where we'll find out what happens with that.
Yeah. Yeah, precisely.
Anyway,
I can't thank you once again enough for coming on, Doctor. Before we let you go, I mean, I found you through the Great Courses series, which is now getting ready to go under another name, Wondrium, or be affiliated with them. But if you get a chance, folks, and you're an Amazon user, go by and check out Great Courses. The Real History of Secret Societies is absolutely amazing. That is it was like 27 hours. I love nothing more than just giving you the microphone, Doctor, and letting you go, because you are a 20 plus year lecturer on topics like this. That's why I wanted to have you on, because I knew you could come in and literally what you did in the last hour, just summing everything up from the 9th century to now and answering a few questions, like quite literally, because once again, we could hearsay, we could conjecture, things like that. But it's really more about understanding the history, what it is, how we got here, and how do we not repeat it?
I thank you for having me on, and you know, thanks for the kind words on that. I do have some experience haranguing people on things, and you know, being told that you've got an hour, you got 20 minutes or whatever, and trying to cram as much in as you can.
Well,
imagine the 20-minute version of this.
Yeah.
So anyway, there's a huge amount. I mean, I gave you basically nothing. I was painting everything in as broad a brush strokes as I possibly could. So if you're interested, there's so much more that you can learn about this. I mean, if you never knew that there was this thing called the Polish Commonwealth, that was one of the biggest countries in Europe for centuries, hey, you can read up on that. So I think, anyway, I'm glad to have you on. And, you know, thanks for the plug about Great Courses.
Well, which tell is, everybody where they can go, because you have some new stuff coming out. You have some other stuff out with Wondrium. You also have, of course, Secret Agent 666, which I have here. You have Wall Street and the Russian Revolution, which I have in Kindle format. So it'll be hard to get that one autographed whenever I meet you eventually one day.
Well, yeah, I've got another book on called Trust No One, sort of a study of a spy named Sidney Reilly, which I'd like to rewrite in so many ways. But all of those are available on Amazon, so you can go to Amazon, find my books there. Again, the great courses are The Real History of Secret Societies. There's another one called Crimes of the Century, A Selective History of Infamy, which if you're into, you know, murders ranging from killer French maids to the assassination of Trotsky, you can take a look at that. And I am just wrapping up work now. It won't be out for some months, partly depending on my schedule, of The Secrets of the Occult. So there you go.
I've got to have you back on about that.
Okay.
Absolutely. The occult is a love niche for me.
Well, it's
honestly, I spent probably the first 6 months of COVID just sitting down and reading alchemical texts, things like that. It's just such a fascinating area of study once you delve into it. And the realm that you have spent, even in Secret Agent 666, going into the world of the occult and espionage tied together during that. Absolutely phenomenal work. So I cannot wait to see what you've done with this.
One more little thing I'll throw in is that Great Courses and Wondrium are they're basically the same thing. But the easiest way you can find my stuff is just look for Great Courses and my name. But also under strictly the Wondrium brand, W-O-N-D-R-I-U-M, I also participated recently in a series for Wondrium 10-part episode called The Secret World of Espionage. So if you're interested, if you want a kind of 101 primer to espionage, you know, apart from all the crap you see in the movies, that's something you might want to take a look at. At any rate, Christopher, it has been great. I hope things go well for the rest of the show. My regards to your next guest and to everybody out there. And thank you.
Absolutely. Once again, thank you so much for your time, Dr. Spence. I will definitely be in touch. Take care, and we'll have you on again very soon.
Good night.
All right. Good night. Wow. Such a always amazing to have Dr. Spence on once again, somebody who spent 20 years and was a actual tenured professor of history teaching a class on U.S. Russian intelligence relations. Really, really cool stuff. Once again, I could sit here and hearsay and conjecture things like that. I prefer to learn the history behind things and figure out how we got to where we are and what we can do to prevent it from happening in the future. Right now, just looking at this, thank you so much, John Hall, for tuning in tonight. absolutely amazing guest. His book about Aleister Crowley and his involvement in the world of espionage is absolutely awesome, as well as his book on Wall Street and the Russian Revolution. Just really, really revelatory stuff. And when you start looking at these things, considering these things, folks, you really do have to have an open mind. And when you're like here in a minute after a commercial break, we will be joined by Anton Schulke, who is actively in the Ukraine. He is in Kyiv, not necessarily a crazy active part, but oddly enough, he has an emergency shelter, and during the show had to run to his emergency shelter because they started shelling locally where he was, at least outbound shelling. So more than likely anti-aircraft fire, something like that. But we will be getting into that with Anton Schulke here in just a minute, right after these messages, folks. Thank you so much for tuning in, as always. We'll be right back. With the rise in attention to the health benefits of cannabis and cannabinoids, including CBD, True Hemp Science has become one of the premier providers of full-spectrum CBD and CBD-related products. Using a proprietary spagyric process, True Hemp Science extracts maximum benefit from the whole hemp plant. Buds, leaves, stems, seeds, even roots. Every part of the plant is used and then reused to formulate a rich, complex profile of CBD, CBD derivatives, and terpenes guaranteed to provide the relief and benefits you need daily. Visit TrueHempScience.com to experience the best CBD oils, edibles, and topicals on the market today. And use code CURIOUS7 to save 7% off your entire purchase of $50 or more and get 2 25-milligram CBD cookies or brownies free. That website again is TrueHempScience.com and the code is CURIOUS7. Have you considered starting a podcast? Looking for a way to make your business a voice of authority in an industry? Then Podcast Cadet is the solution for you. Whether starting a podcast for yourself, your brand, business, school, church, or just plain fun, Podcast Cadet is here to help you navigate the waters of the podcast industry. Specializing in one-on-one consultation and training with industry professionals in fields ranging from podcast technology and editing to distribution, monetization, and even social media strategies, Podcast Cadet tailors their services to the specific needs of you and your podcast. Do you already have a podcast and trying to find ways to engage and grow your audience? Sign up for your Podcast Cadet audit today. And let us help you explore new and exciting ways to leverage your content and elevate your podcast brand to whole new levels. From consultation and workshops to affordable podcast production and maintenance packages, Podcast Cadet is your one-stop shop for everything podcast-related on the internet. Visit PodcastCadet.com today to sign up for your consultation or training. And use code CURIOUS20 to save 20% off your entire purchase. That website again is podcastcadet.com. Curious Realm Podcast is your source for the latest and greatest news and events in the world of the paranormal, esoteric, and forbidden knowledge. And there's no better way to spark the conversation than with items from the Curious Realm store. Choose from fan favorites like hoodies, mouse pads, coffee mugs, and more. Buy books and items from your favorite Curious Realm guests. Get your hands on the latest gear for paranormal investigations and experiments we discuss on the show. Open your web browser and stop on by the Curious Realm store at CuriousRealm.com/store to buy the latest Curious Realm wear and out-of-this-world gifts for yourself, your family, or a mind that you want to open. That website again is CuriousRealm.com/store. And we are back, folks. Thank you so much to all of our sponsors, as always, especially our new sponsor, WebWork Wireless. WebWorks Wireless is a great solution for your wireless folks. They have been sponsoring our live website streams for the last month almost now. The first couple weeks secretly, and the last couple weeks pretty publicly. We almost competed with our live stream numbers on Facebook this last week, on our website. So very exciting stuff, especially with us coming into the world of live conferences again and going out, sponsoring things like the upcoming 52nd annual MUFON conference that we will be live streaming from, things like that. Our guest, as promised in this second hour, not directly on the front, but about as close to a front as you would probably ever really want to get, folks. Welcome to the program, Anton Schulke. How are you doing today?
Hi. I wish I were not that close to front, honestly.
Yeah.
But I'm doing fine. Okay. Yeah. With all the circumstances we are in, yeah, I'm doing very, very well. Thank you.
Yeah. And, you know, in the first part of the show, we had history professor Richard B. Spence on talking about Russian-Ukrainian history and kind of some of the things that have, I guess, led up to this craziness from Russia right now, saying that they are, like, reclaiming Russia, I guess, and what used to be part of Russia. What have things been like over there for you, your family? I know on social media you have been sharing pictures of yourself every few days in your makeshift shelter that you have over there. But where you are right now, life is still at least somewhat normal. You've had curfews, things like that. But let's get into what things have been like and how this has impacted your family and those that you know that are closer to the action.
Well, always a life change completely. Just and probably will never be same again. We getting used. It's a day for today. We getting used to it, if I may say. But we were very, very lucky. There is no shooting, no shelling, no bombing where I am. I do hear anti-aircraft fire from time to time. I'm not military expert, so I think it is anti-aircraft fire. So and that's probably it. We did have a curfew. We do have a curfew every night now, but we did have a long curfew from Saturday, I think from Saturday 5 p.m. till today, till Monday 8 a.m. And after that, everyone went to get shopping. My wife was in a queue for 2 hours, but shops are still full of food. Even cheap food is basically going cheap, long life food like flour, sugar, and the bread is a problem, because obviously bread you have to produce. But problem not that it doesn't, there is no such a thing. You can find, but you have to be lucky. But otherwise, first couple of days I was trying to kind of go business as usual and everything, but it's very, very difficult to do it now, because you basically you're watching news from front, which is sounds absolutely, if somebody would say it like a few months ago, it would be absolutely ridiculous. But no, exactly. So I'm just trying to not. I don't want to remember it, but you can't get away. You can't go away. I remember all this old movie about Second World War and everything, and now I kind of feel what that people feel, and I don't really want to feel it like so. Honestly.
Well, and it's got to be more than a stressful situation, like you said. There, even though there is not active shelling where you are, even to hear the regularity of fire in the distance, you know, that is something that will put you on edge pretty quick.
It probably does. And I always think, you think, okay, it might come here, because it's war just started, it hasn't stopped, and it doesn't look like it's gonna stop. And obviously Putin is very determined to get Kyiv. Well, I don't know. I I think so. Yeah, I obviously cannot know that. So it looks like that. So far, I don't think it was a real struggle for Kyiv, but it might soon. So, and yeah. This is very worrying, obviously.
Well, you say boring, but
no, I said worrying.
Oh, worrying.
It was very boring, here so far in terms of nobody kill anyone around me, so which is very nice. But it's very we are very worried that it might change.
Yeah, yeah, and that's just it. This is a situation that could turn on a dime. When it started, there was no real, quote, inkling of invasion. It was like, hey, we're coming over here to do some military exercises. And as of yesterday, Putin put his nuclear arsenal on high alert. You know, all kinds of strange things. The whole action of this happening. And granted, there have been rumblings for years about something like this, but at the same time, the fact that it just out and out happened almost out of nowhere, the fact that the Ukrainian army has been able to hold its own the way that it has been absolutely phenomenal.
Yeah, it was I think the Ukrainian army and territorial army, which is basically volunteers. Mm-hmm. They're holding their ground, and I don't think anyone besides themselves, of course, expected doing them well. When we're saying it's out of blue and everything, it's not really true. The war started in 2014 and been here with us since then. Mm. It's what, 8 years. The war wasn't in Kyiv. And we kind of, and I realize how wrong I was, because war was there on Donbass. Okay, 2014-15 was really combat. After that, it was just staying there. But still, life were lost almost every day. But we kind of, I kind of didn't care, because it's okay, it's just over there. But today is here, and well, obviously, I learned my lesson, but I hope everyone will learn lesson, but not my way. I don't want the war will be where you are or where everyone who is listening where they are. But right now, war is here and probably somewhere else. This is probably the hottest war, but a war is everywhere. And you kind of, when it's here, you kind of change your mind and you understand before that you were absolutely stupid idiot, because you thought, oh, well, just war was over there. Who cares? So, well, this is my lesson so far.
Yeah. Yeah. And that is a very good cautionary tale, Anton, to share, because once again, I think everybody the world over kind of takes for granted the situation in which they live, and even the comforts in which they live. You know, even the fact of you being under curfew, not being able to go to stores regularly, having to wait in queue for 2, 3, sometimes numerous hours for regular supplies. I mean, good Lord, look at what happened over here in the States when COVID hit. Now imagine if we were going through something like what you guys are going through. Like, it would be madness in the streets.
Well, you did just a long time ago, and obviously you, me, we don't remember that, of course. Yeah, and I wish we wouldn't remember it today. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Precisely. It would be a hard situation for most Americans, I think, to go through this. And I'm sure it's a hard situation for every Ukrainian going through
it
right now.
Sure.
You know, and kudos to your Minister Prime over there for bucking up and actually putting on armor himself. That
as a president.
Your president. Sorry. Yeah, like that is absolutely amazing. I can't say that our president would do the same.
You never know.
Well, I mean, it would be pretty doubtful. They have a lot of bunkers for him all over the place.
Well, United States is a very different country, so well, yeah. it's a different story. Well, yeah, but we had plenty of questions to our president, obviously, and his rating was very low before this, and now it's like a triple, like 90% support him, and it's probably a very typical thing for nation in a war, sure. but he's doing fantastically well. So hopefully it stays this way. Well,
yeah, exactly. And hopefully, not only does the morale of the Ukrainian people stay up amidst all this, but hopefully we can find some way to, I guess, be able to build more bridges to be able to talk more across lines about these kinds of situations and really be there for each other as nations and people. It's interesting even now, like when COVID first started, Anton, I did quite a few episodes where we had COVID check-ins from people around the world. And it's interesting now to have the connectivity that we have to even right now as over across the river and down the road from you, there is shelling and artillery going on. We are able to have an internet conversation right now.
Yeah, which just surprised me as well. Yeah. We do have electricity, internet. We do have absolutely everything. So far, absolutely everything is intact, which does surprise me. Well, it's a good surprise. I wanted to say this way, but it does surprise me. Because I read about Elon Musk, mm-hmm. and his satellites have something moving here to help us. But I guess it's not something which you can really fix within 15 minutes or a couple of days. Probably will take months and everything. So, but yeah, everything works and it's fantastic. And, you know, I think we had more panic in the shop when the COVID started. I went to shop today. As I said, we were staying in the queue for a couple of hours and with no panic, no fighting, no anything. So, which is makes me even a little bit of proud of ourselves. So, but I wish we wouldn't have this kind of challenges.
Well, and hey, if change is going to happen, if things are going to happen, it's one thing if they happen in a slow and steady process. It's another thing to have people rolling over bridges overnight. You know, like I said, this was something that really just popped up out of nowhere when it happened. And the response of the Ukrainian people to it has been absolutely phenomenal. It's been great to see that y'all were able to rally as fast as you were and prepare yourselves as fast as you did.
Yeah.
Now, what have things been like for your family, things like that, Anton? What are y'all looking at over the next week or so?
We don't. We live by day. So today was a good day so far. We went to shop, we got our supplies, we were not shelter bombed. And so far, no sirens either, but they usually at nighttime. That's it. We're not planning for a week.
Yeah. Yeah. And even right now, I've been popping up every now and then this live feed that somebody sent me from Kyiv. And it's really interesting to sit and watch the live feeds going on there and to know that right now, like you said, things are quiet. Things are on the quiet side. So hopefully things are starting to kind of simmer down a little bit. Like I said a minute ago, there were talks of truce talks, ceasefire, all kinds of things. So hopefully that can be the case as stuff moves forward over the next few days.
I personally doubt that it will stop now, but it would be fantastic if it would. We'll see how it goes.
What would make you say that it won't stop now?
I don't want to step in some kind of politologist or expert in international or military expert. I think not so far. Putin has achieved absolutely nothing. Not any big city been taken, including Kyiv, and army didn't collapse. So nothing has happened. So why would they stay? It's just 4 days. I don't think over there. Oh, can you hear it?
Yep.
Yeah, it's a distant fire.
Wow.
Yeah, so, okay, we probably will go to shelter. So, absolutely. Okay, just to finish it up.
Yeah.
Nothing has been achieved from their point of view, and they absolutely sure they might achieve it. So I don't see why they stop it. Okay,
go to the shelter.
Okay.
Take care. Thank you so much for checking in with us, Anton. We'll have to check in with you periodically and make sure things are going well. Take care.
Okay, cheers. Bye.
All right. Wow. So absolutely incredible, folks. Thank you so much, Anton. That is absolutely amazing of you to come on. Please do be safe out there. Man, I cannot express to you what it is to actively hear a live fire going on outside. And I'm gonna pop up those videos again real quick from the live stream from Kyiv, just to see if we can see anything popping off or anything like that before we let you go, folks. But that new experiences all the time. First time I've ever heard artillery fire over the other end of my episode. So stay safe out there, Anton. Please, whatever you do, make sure to take care of yourself, take care of your family. Thank you so much for taking the time to come on. Thank you so much to everybody, as always, for tuning in. Make sure to stop on by, like, subscribe, check out the website. CuriousRealm.com is where you want to go for everything. CuriousRealm.com/live to see the amazing live feed every week provided by WebWorks Wireless. Thank you so much to you guys. Thank you so much for everybody. Take care of yourselves. Take care of each other. Pray for the Ukraine. And remember, stay curious. Talk to you soon. Thank you for tuning into this episode of The Curious Realm. Stay tuned for more guests, forbidden topics, and hidden truths. Download the official Curious Realm app and view the Knowledge Vault on our website, CuriousRealm.com. Follow us on social media by searching Curious Realm. Curious Realm is available on your favorite podcast services, as well as YouTube, Roku, Amazon Fire, and Apple TV through the APR TV app, available on all app markets. Curious Realm is a proud member of the HC Universal Network family of podcasts. For more great content or to become a sponsor of Curious Realm or other podcasts, visit HCUniversalNetwork.com today. Thanks for listening. Stay curious. And remember, the other side is always watching.